Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point with a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. To our guests in the hall and listeners around the country, welcome to On Point Live. The campaign for the presidency 2016 has already been a contest like no other. A TV star, billionaire, and a former first lady, senator, secretary of state, a democratic socialist who came from nowhere to nearly upend the Democratic Party, language like we've never heard, the GOP in turmoil, a new generation setting its compass. Now comes the turn to the general election. We want to size up this season and where it is taking us. We've got a great crew with us to do that at a pivotal moment in the campaign. This hour on Point with a live audience and taking on the election season 2016. We're recording this show with our audience at the beautiful Paramount Theater in downtown Boston. We have invited questions from our audience here and from across the country online. We are loaded for bear, so let's go. Let me introduce my guests here on stage. Molly Ball, politics reporter for The Atlantic. She's been all over the campaign trail this year, covering Trump rallies, Sanders rallies. When she won the Syracuse Toner Prize for Journalism, the dean of the school called her political coverage superb journalism that illuminates the people and policies that shape us as a nation. Molly Ball, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you, Molly. And with us, NPR's own Asma Khalid, my former colleague at WBUR here, now deep in the twists and turns and demographics of the 2016 race. Asma Khalid, in person, welcome. It's so great to have you here. Next, McKay Coppins is with us here on the stage. Senior political writer for BuzzFeed News. He's been all over the Republicans' wild ride this year. His book is Into the Wilderness, Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. Donald Trump called him a scumbag. He's got the funniest Twitter feed out there. McKay Coppins, great to have you with us tonight. And last but not least, On Point's own formidable news analyst, great sage of human affairs, our very own Jack Beatty. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Let's see. We have a couple of other voices that we want you to hear tonight. We're going to be talking a lot about them. Hillary wants you to know Donald Trump does not have the right stuff, the right temperament to be president.
He is not just unprepared. He is temperamentally unfit to hold an office that requires knowledge, stability, and immense responsibility.
Just in case you wanted to know, we all heard that, and Donald Trump wants you to know Hillary is flawed, deeply flawed.
We call her Crooked Hillary because she's a crooked person. You look at Whitewater, you go back to Whitewater, look at what's happening with the emails, and so many different things. You look at the foundation. She is a person who's got many, many flaws. If she's a woman, but yet women don't like her.
And we're just getting started. We are just getting started here. Molly Ball, what have we got ourselves into in this election? Here we are. It looks like Hillary and Trump now, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You know, we've been at this for a couple of hundred years plus, and this is where we've come in 2016. And what do you make of what has brought us here?
Well, the American people are clearly masochists because they have elected as their major party nominees the two most unpopular presidential nominees in history, as far as we know. Now, I don't mean to equivalize
the
two.
The people say that themselves. You poll them, and they say we don't like him.
People really don't like either of these people, and yet, you know, a majority of Republicans chose Donald Trump. A majority of Democrats chose Hillary Clinton. I think we witnessed a sort of coming apart of both parties in a way, certainly more severe on the Republican side. And certainly we've been, nobody who's been covering the Republican Civil War, as McKay and I both have for the last several years, could be too surprised at how deep the divisions are. But this cycle has reoriented the divisions around a different axis than we were used to. It wasn't as much ideological as it was about sort of attitude and class in a way. And on the Democratic side, I don't think I certainly, or a lot of other people, realized how much energy there was on the left of the party and how much, especially youthful energy, was really looking for something radical. And so I think what we've heard from both sides of the political spectrum is that people are so deeply frustrated that they feel these are dire times, extreme times, that call for extreme solutions. And that's why we've seen the elevation of these sort of non-traditional voices. Now, the Democrats, the establishment won. It's important to remember that as much as Bernie Sanders seemed like a disruptive force in the party and an unexpected force, he didn't win the primary. So the Democrats are still betting on this establishment, sort of institutionally minded candidate in an age that seems to be much more about disruption.
McKay, if we're at a fork in the road, then if Hillary, well, you tell us what Hillary stands for, but Trump stands for something new, I think. What's the choice in front of the American public at this point? It feels to me like a little pause. We had the primary roller coaster that just went and went and went. Soon we'll have the conventions and then that hard drive to the November voting day. We're at a kind of pause right now. What brought us here, McKay?
Well, I think that particularly on the right with the Republicans, you know, there has been for the last certainly 8 years, maybe longer, a lot of anger and anxiety in the electorate, right? And with the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, a lot of people interpreted and kind of channeled that anger into demands for absolute ideological purity, right? That was what, in the 2010 midterms, we saw all these Republicans who would stray even a little bit from hard right orthodoxy lose primaries. And so there was this idea that what Republican voters really wanted was absolute purity when it came to their ideology.
Or so we thought.
That's what we thought. But what I think Donald Trump has shown is that for a lot of voters, and including a lot of people who identified as Tea Partiers back then, it wasn't actually about ideology, or at least not mostly about that. It was about emotion and anger and a kind of visceral response to a lot of the problems that are plaguing this country and Washington, D.C. And what Donald Trump has been able to do, and I think what a lot of reporters and pundits, myself included, missed about Trump early on, was that we all thought there was no way Trump could become the Republican nominee, if only because he was the most ideologically, politically promiscuous candidate in the field, by far, right? And then as it turns out, that doesn't matter so much to a whole huge chunk of the electorate, including Republican primary voters. And so when we look at the general election, I don't think we're necessarily going to see this framed as two different agendas, two different sets of policies that are competing. I think we're going to see, more so than even any other Republican or presidential campaign in a long time, two personalities, two characters, and their subsets of the electorate going to battle over that. And I think that's what we're going to hear a lot about in the general election.
Molly says, you know, people think things are so dire, and some people miss that. The leadership of each party didn't seem ready for the challenge that emerged in each party in this election. When you look at the demographics, Ozma, can you say, here are the people, the groups or the veins of Americans, pretty big veins, who are most in this, the situation is dire, frame of mind?
Are we talking about the Republicans or the Democrats?
In both parties. By age, by income, by region. There are a lot of these. There are a lot of our fellow Americans who don't think the status quo is cool at all. Who are they?
That's true. There is a good chunk. But I do want to reiterate what Molly said earlier, which is that Hillary Clinton is the presumptive Democratic nominee. And so there is a chunk, I would say, of people who do want that status quo. The chunk who doesn't want that status quo, I think, is sort of multifaceted. I think that there are certainly large swaths of white working class voters. I don't think that's much of a surprise to folks who had covered the primaries, but I think it's broader than that. I spent some time in Ohio recently and went door to door with a group that's called Working America. They're affiliated with the AFL-CIO. And they're sort of in this process of just trying to understand where voters are. These are white working class voters in sort of the exurbs of Cleveland, you could say. And the most common sentiment I heard from people was this sort of apathy, but also disappointment with the process. They're very dissatisfied with the candidates. You know, they say that their life, their personal economic situation has not improved really one iota in the last 8 years. And so I think that, yes, there's a large chunk of white working class voters, and I think that that was some of the support we saw during the primary for Donald Trump. But I also think that, you know, one thing that we haven't really discussed yet so far for where we see some of these cleavages is along race. And I think we'd be very sort of remiss to ignore some of that. I think that part of why we have seen on the Democratic side a desire for the status quo, one could argue, is that there are large chunks of minorities who have fought and fought to be a part of that status quo.
Yep.
And they are now part of that status quo, and they want continuity.
And if they don't have that, they don't know what they'll have, so there's uncertainty, perhaps, in that quadrant. Jack, if it's two personalities that are going to be the driving force of this home stretch to the vote, and not policies exactly, though we know policies will come up, but what are the implications of having such a personality-driven campaign at a time when people feel that there are many things that are seriously out of whack, things that may not be fixed by personality?
Yes, the discontent is more likely to be fanned than alleviated. Every time you saw how Mr. Trump reacted to Orlando, no calming, he just threw more
gas
wood on the fire.
Yeah, yeah.
That's his instinct. That's what he'll be doing throughout. He's going to be, ripping Clinton's ethics and morals and the whole Clinton saga. And meanwhile, she's just going to be saying he's not fit to be president. And every time he goes into one of his rants, more people, I think, are going to say, well, maybe she's right. That is, she's shifted the race to make he's the issue in this campaign. Whether this man, an authoritarian quasi-racist with no impulse control, can be president of the United States. I mean, that is the issue, I think.
But,
and I think she's made that the issue.
But if people want to explode the system, a lot of people want to explode it, not sustain it,
yeah,
and they're not in an elite that's happy with the status quo, maybe that argument doesn't take the day. Maybe it's exactly that volatility in Donald Trump that is the appeal.
And that connects with something, some fundamental dissatisfaction, alienation in the electorate, in the white electorate.
Do you think you could call this election sitting here right now tonight, Jack? Could you confidently call how it's going to turn out?
Well, the chart on Real Clear Politics shows one line going up and one line going down. Those are the trends. Hillary's going up, he's going down. Could reverse.
There's the direction and the reverse. We are talking about this remarkable campaign season. On stage with me here, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Asma Khalid of NPR, McKay Coppins from BuzzFeed News, and our own Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Astrick with a beautiful hall at the Paramount Theater in Boston, and this is On Point Live. I'm Tom Astrick with Molly Ball, McKay Coppins, Asma Khalid, and Jack Beatty in a live audience in Boston, and this is On Point Live. We're not taking questions or calls this hour, but we have lots of questions from folks here in the hall with us in Boston and from all of our listeners around the country. I want to begin to put those to our guests. McKay Coppins, it's been tough for you sometimes. I don't know if it's tough or not. Donald Trump called you a scumbag. Brenda.
Well, we put that on our Amazon page.
Yeah, of course, right away. I want to talk about Donald Trump and the press, but Brenda asks, and I'll put it to you, is this election cycle the luckiest thing to ever happen to you professionally?
I think yes is the answer.
Great.
I don't want to pull the president of CBS famously or now notoriously said that Donald Trump's rise was bad for America but great for CBS. I think that's basically true for my career and my book sales too. But I think that the thing about Donald Trump that a lot of people have complained about so much this whole campaign season, is certainly a lot of Republicans who are anti-Trump, was that the media clearly, and that goes for TV, for online, across the board, there was so much interest, so much captivation when it is surrounding Donald Trump that the more you covered him, the more audience you got, the more clicks you got, the higher your ratings were. And Donald Trump, the theory goes that Donald Trump, took advantage of that, and especially when early on in the primaries, when there were 16 other candidates, he benefited immensely from getting all that free exposure. The New York Times, I think, calculated that he got $2 billion in free media, all told, throughout the primaries.
Molly, Nigel asks, to what extent is the media responsible for Trump, and what can or should be done about this? Michael writes to us on Facebook. He says, one candidate gets overwhelmingly more coverage than the other candidates. While voters decide, air quotes, elections, the media makes the candidates. Is there something of an urge for bread and circus here that has played out in front of us all, maybe in our hands? It's not like we're talking about somebody else.
I take issue happen, with this whole premise that we are responsible just because, look, nobody would argue that we should cover all of the candidates equally and they should all get sort of 5-minute chunks. The candidate who is more interesting or makes more news is going to be covered more, and one candidate is clearly more interesting both to us and to our audiences. It's a little bit rich to hear a candidate like Ted Cruz, who gives the same speech over and over, complain about the fact that a candidate who is unscripted and provocative is therefore going to be more newsworthy. And it's interesting to me also, I mean, these complaints mostly come from people who don't like Donald Trump. So their disagreement is with the outcome, and I think their disagreement is ultimately with Republican primary voters. And I don't think that Republican primary voters were duped into making a choice that they would not have made with different information. I think, much to the surprise of a lot of the media who were giving all this coverage to Trump, of that $2 billion, about $1 billion, you'd have to say, was a giant attack ad, right? Mm-hmm. There's a reason that politicians pay money to attack their opponents, even if that's giving them quote-unquote exposure. A lot of it was negative, but Republican primary voters still saw something that they liked there. And so I think that they have the agency in this process and that Donald Trump has the agency in this process. You know, another politician who was very good at getting a lot of media exposure was Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And somehow that was because he was a master communicator. But when Trump does it, it's not to his credit. It's somehow the media's fault. So I think a lot of these people just have an issue with the outcome and would like it to have been different.
Osmond, what about the other side of the ledger and the Democrats? There were many complaints during this whole long stretch, and Bernie Sanders is now beginning to talk in a kind of valedictory way, but he has not conceded. He hasn't endorsed Hillary Clinton, and we'll see what happens at the conventions. But the complaint has been out there, blackout around Bernie Sanders. Blackout, blackout, blackout. The Sanders supporters saying he never got enough attention, the right kind of attention from the media. What do you think about that, Asma?
I have to concur with Molly on sort of the same side, on the Democratic side. I mean, I would say most reputable news organizations had tasked reporters to both the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Sanders campaign. And I would say, you know, here we at NPR had reporters who were often going around following both of those candidates. I think that there's a frustration from the loser side. I think that is sort of the way it works, is that the camp that did not come out on top feels frustrated with the outcome. I think that there's very little to prove that throughout the campaign season that in some way Bernie Sanders was actually blacked out.
Jack, we'll come back to Bernie, but one question on that front. Is it not possible that the media embodies a kind of prejudice for the status quo? I mean, most of the people in the media, for one thing, have a job.
Yeah.
So they're, you know... So it's working for them at some level, and is it possible the media is just kind of in the thrall of the way things are? And as much as people complain about that, that they're just not ready to have the stretch of imagination that Bernie Sanders supporters have, or would say they have, had.
Yeah, you know, it's like the Katharine Hepburn's acting, all the range from A to B.
I like Katharine Hepburn.
Yes, so do I. But what I think is different about this cycle, and I think our guests show it from the shows they've been on, is that the Bernie Sanders words are used all the time. Inequality. Tom, you did a show on, we did a week-long shows on inequality in 2003, I think, and it was like some, what do you mean inequality?
What are you talking about? What's the big deal?
Yeah, well,
it's everything.
It's everything. And that's Bernie. You know, that's the question that he's put on, and it's not going to go away. And Republicans, of course, it wasn't brought up in Republican debates that I heard, but they're going to have to answer, what's your solution? So I do think that the upper middle class, a professional class media has been pushed just in responding, and even give him his due. Trump talks about what's happened to wages, talks about what's happened to manufacturing jobs. I mean, he's pilloried the Carrier Corporation as a kind of, you know, paradigm.
Making
of
air conditioners in Mexico. Yeah, Mexico.
and you know, I'm going to get back those jobs from China. So suddenly, issues that were off the table from the American consensus are right there now, and the media has to pay attention.
Let's hear from these two. In February, after he won the New Hampshire primary, Donald Trump laid out his vision for a Trump administration. It was pretty simple. The theme, winning.
We are going to start winning again. We don't win anymore as a country. We don't win on trade. We don't win with the military. We can't beat ISIS. We don't win with anything. We are going to start winning again, and we're going to win so much, you are going to be so happy. We are going to make America so great again, maybe greater than ever before.
So great. That's where we're headed with Donald Trump. Earlier this month, Hillary Clinton laid out her vision for a future America.
Our campaign will take this message to every corner of our country. We're stronger when our economy works for everyone, not just those at the top, with good paying jobs and good schools in every zip code, and a real commitment to all families and all regions of our nation.
Kate Coppins, when you listen to those two, it sounds like two very different visions of what winning is. With Donald Trump, it sounds like a kind of triumphalism, though he says it's for the little guy. With Hillary Clinton, it's a kind of link arms and be the village. We're all in this together, and when we're all together, we've won.
Sure. Yeah, well, absent from that, I think, is what's notable is neither of those visions kind of are championing the conservative individualism that a lot of traditional conservatives championed, that we pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and we go out there and we start businesses and we overcome all of the obstacles in our way. I mean, I covered the Mitt Romney campaign in 2012. Half of his stump speech every day, and I memorized it. To Molly's point, that he could have mixed it up a little bit, but it was all about small business owners. It was all about the bosses. And mm-hmm. What I think Donald Trump has done is orient his message more toward the people who have gotten laid off by the small business owners and the bosses. And while it's not as inclusive sounding as Hillary Clinton's message, at least from those two clips you played, it still is. He's reaching out to the little guy, to the guy getting put out or screwed over by the
professional
class.
But what is he proposing for that guy?
Well,
or that
this
gal?
Is this is the issue. Well, okay, so to give him his due, he doesn't talk about policy all that much. The things that he does talk about are immigration and trade. Right, those are kind of the two issues that are at the centerpiece of his campaign. If you're actually looking policy-wise at his platform, and those are two issues where he, particularly on trade, but really on both issues, he has broken ranks with the mainstream DC Republican elite, and that has made a huge difference. And I think that one of the things that we should take away from this election, after all is said and done, when the dust has settled, Republicans are going to have to revisit their how they approach these issues, hopefully subtract all the xenophobia and outrageous things that are kind of woven into Trump's message, but look at how they can actually reach out to those white working class voters that Trump has rallied, because it's not just about attitude and it's not just about the stuff he says. It is, to a certain extent, a clash of interests here, and Trump has exposed that.
I mean, Molly, can you subtract the xenophobia? Can you subtract the nationalism? And if you do, who is President Trump?
Well, look, I think even more than a clash of personalities, this election is a clash of cultures between the traditionalists and the cosmopolitans. And the people who feel this country is going through very rapid change, demographic change. As Asma said, we're going to be a majority minority country before long. You have a rapidly urbanizing, modernizing, technologizing culture that has left a lot of people behind and left them feeling left out, whether it's because they worked in manufacturing industries that are now effectively defunct, or because their neighbors and their communities don't look like they used to, or because the sort of values that they feel they were raised with are no longer the prevailing values of the culture.
But is Donald Trump going to deport 11 million people? Is he going to go to trade war with China if he were elected president?
Look, I would never try to tell you what Donald Trump is going to do, even 5 minutes from now. But listen to his message. His slogan is Make America Great Again. It is explicitly nostalgic. Mm-hmm. And he is saying, with both the immigration plank and the trade plank of his platform, he is literally saying, I am going to protect you from change. His economic policy is literally protectionist. And on immigration, he is going to build a wall to keep the people out. Protect you with literally a building. So he is offering to assuage people's fear and anxiety by literally protecting them from the scary outside forces that they feel they're at the mercy of.
Asma, here's a question from Barnaby. It says, right now there's a mess of Republicans who feel disenfranchised, even if they may not be. How can Hillary's message reach them? Can Hillary Clinton reach the middle of the road Republican who may be put off by Donald Trump's presentation?
Well, I went out to Ohio actually to try to test that very theory, mm-hmm. and I will say I did not meet a number of Republicans who were willing to sort of jump ship and join the Hillary Clinton camp. What I did meet were people who did feel disaffected, who say they may not vote for president this election cycle, and this would theoretically be the first time in their life that they don't vote for president. But I think that the difficulty, as Molly was saying earlier, is that both of these candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, have extremely high unfavorabilities. I mean, neither one of these candidates is very well liked by the public. So if people dislike Donald Trump, if they feel disaffected, I don't think that we're going to see droves of them supporting Hillary Clinton. What we might see are folks who have crossed party lines before, and what we might see are sort of folks who are more in sort of the traditional establishment ranks of the Republican Party. But your sort of average suburban voters in sort of, you know, some community outside of Columbus, I don't think you're going to see droves of them shift to Hillary Clinton, partly because she is in herself a very polarizing figure to many traditional Republicans.
Does Hillary Clinton need them? Or when you look at the demographics, when you look at the polls, when you look at previous election campaigns, structurally, who appears to have the advantage at this point? Here we are, middle of June.
Hands down, I would say Hillary Clinton has a demographic edge. We've done a demographic analysis where we essentially superimposed how Barack Obama would have performed given 2016 demographics. He has, or whoever, generic Democratic candidate, has the clear advantage. It looks like states like Virginia, which we had sort of traditionally thought of as battleground states, do not seem to be as much at play, partly because of the growing Latino and the Asian population there. So the demographic advantage is in Hillary Clinton's camp. Where I think she needs to be careful is there are some communities, and I would argue a group like white women that Barack Obama lost by about 14 points to Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. That's a group where she, as you know, potentially the first female president, could try to make inroads, and it would be to her advantage because who knows if she can bring turnout rates at the level that Barack Obama did, either in 2008 or 2012.
Jack, therefore, if it was Barack Obama running again, Asma says the demographics look good. Donald Trump's complaint or charge is, the Republicans' charge, is that a Hillary Clinton administration would be a third term of the Obama administration. Do you think so, Jack? And what does that mean to you? What would it mean to you?
I do think it would be a third term. I mean, I think we'd see a cast of characters who might be an eclectic cast of characters, people who were lower down in jobs in this administration and people from the first Clinton administration. So I think in personnel, it would be there'd be continuity in policy. I mean, I'm not up with all of her positions, but it does seem to me that she's basically tacking on a kind of Bernie valence to each of the Obama positions. I want to do a little more here, a little more there, a little more here. But it's very much, and by the way, I think that was really crucial to her appeal. She said to the base of this party, to which Bernie had very little appeal, minority voters, I want continuity with the first African-American president. That meant so much. I mean, she was saying, you know, we can complain about him, but he's done pretty well, don't you agree? And for all the talk about disruption, as you say, she did get the 3 million more votes. The base of the party that saw her through, they didn't want change. They wanted continuity. And every time she raised Barack Obama, her stock, of course, it was also had a legacy familiarity from Bill Clinton, but that helped. So I do think it would be continuity.
McKay, the polls all have said for a while now, and right through the Obama administration, Americans are very unhappy about the direction of the country.
Yeah.
So if it's Hillary Clinton, and I mean, Jack says it looks like a third Obama term in a way to him, she would argue perhaps, or maybe not. Maybe that's a selling point. But if people are so unhappy and her message is more of the same,
right?
How does that add up?
Well, this was a reason that a lot of people thought Barack Obama was going to be a one-term president. Because if you polled the country in 2011, heading into the 2012 race, it was also, the economic indicators were not good. There was a large number of people who said the country was on the wrong track. It might be, and I mean, this is a pessimistic viewpoint, but it might be that people are going to just think that the country is on the wrong track indefinitely, depending.
What the hell?
Regardless of what happens. Look, it's not my fault. I think I love America.
Well, but whose fault it is great again. The voters. I mean, the voters choose a different party every 2 years and then complain about gridlock.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. Okay. Here we are. Wherever we are, we're locked in. I don't know. I don't know if people are really going to go with that. We are talking about this remarkable 2016 campaign season with Molly Ball, politics writer for The Atlantic, Asma Khalid, NPR politics reporter. You know her from the NPR Politics podcast, and McKay Coppins, senior political writer for BuzzFeed News, author of The Wilderness. Jack Beatty is here. We've got questions that have come in from you on Facebook and Twitter and our website, onpointradio.org. Here in the Paramount Theater in Boston, I am with a beautiful audience, and this is On Point Live. I'm Tom Ashbrook at the Paramount Theater in downtown Boston, and this is On Point Live. We are stepping back this hour for a big look at the 2016 campaign with Molly Ball of The Atlantic, McKay Coppins of BuzzFeed, Asma Khalid of NPR, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. We have heard from Donald Trump. We have heard from Hillary Clinton, and then there's Bernie Sanders. After the last primary vote, he was almost shifting gears on the election, but not his revolution.
Election days come and go, but political and social revolutions that attempt to transform our society never end.
Bernie Sanders, not conceding, not endorsing Hillary Clinton, but talking in more valedictory terms, perhaps, about where he's headed. Jack, do you see in the Sanders movement, a political and social revolution that will sustain?
I mean, he called, I thought it was very interesting, he called for his supporters to run for local offices, actually to start up a kind of party of the Bernie all across the country. He said, get involved in your local, change the benches of the Democratic Party, change it from inside.
Isn't that a good idea if you want big change?
It's absolutely a good idea, and especially change for the long haul, which Bernie definitely is in. But there is the phenomenon to which you advert that there are two electorates. There's the general electorate and the fired up and ready to go electorate that put Barack Obama in, and young people and minorities. And then there's the we're going to get you back electorate in the off years when older white folks vote and put a veto the decision that was made 2 years previously. And unless the Democrats can find some way out of that dilemma, unless Bernie can fire up his supporters in the off years, I don't know that he will make any change. That is the thing that has to be changed. And he said that. He said, when the Democrats vote, when people turn out to vote, we win. When fewer vote, we lose. And it's his task now, it seems to me, if he wants to lead this movement, to fire up those people to vote in the off years.
Molly, what kind of role do you see for Bernie Sanders, first at the convention and then beyond? I mean, he has met in recent days with Hillary Clinton. I don't know exactly what's being negotiated there, but he's promising his supporters, in effect, that whether he comes out on top or not, and we see how that seems to be going at this moment, he's going to continue leading a movement. What do you see coming from his quarter?
Well, I'm not a fly on that particular wall either, unfortunately, but I would say a couple of sort of contradictory things. On the one hand, I think ever since the Occupy movement, there has been this rising liberal sentiment that needed somewhere to go, needed a leader, needed someone to channel it. And you had Elizabeth Warren doing that somewhat, but there really wasn't a national leader for this rising progressive energy. The number of Americans who describe themselves as liberal is at its highest point in 20 or 30 years, but they are still a much smaller segment than the number of Americans calling themselves conservative. And even in the Democratic Party, they are a minority. So I would say Bernie doesn't just need to get his people fired up to vote in off years. He needs to get them fired up to vote in Democratic primaries. You still, this year, in all of the down ballot races, the establishment candidate won every single time in those Democratic primaries. So in the Senate race in Maryland, there was a sort of Bernie-esque outsider candidate who lost. Same thing in the Democratic primary in Pennsylvania. And so if they are not even a majority of the Democratic Party, it's going to be difficult for Bernie to move his adopted party to the left, much less the country as a whole.
What do you think it means, Asma, if you have a younger generation or some significant piece of it that feels so passionately for what Bernie Sanders has represented? Where does that go? If it's Hillary Clinton and Bernie is there, but he's on the sidelines and he's cheering on, but he's not going to be with us forever, and this generation will be here for a long time. Where does that sentiment go? Does it just dissipate? Does it melt back into the mainstream? Or do you see in the demographics or in the passion the makings of something long-term?
I think that's really hard to predict right now. I think part of the immediate change will depend on what role Bernie actually takes on in this election cycle, right? So will this be a large population that comes out and supports Hillary Clinton? Part of that depends on what Bernie decides to do. But the momentum and the enthusiasm that we've seen from this younger demographic, I do not think is going to dissipate. I mean, look, I went on this really interesting tour when I was in Indiana during the primaries to the Eugene V. Debs house, right? Mm-hmm. Debs is the socialist candidate for president. And the guy there, who very much subscribed to Deb's sort of way of life.
Well, you didn't
said to
say
me,
Indiana. You said India?
Indiana.
Okay, okay,
Jimmy
okay.
Debs
okay.
In Indiana.
Okay.
And then long story short, he basically said to me that he felt like Debs paved the way for FDR in the New Deal. That Debs might have been so out of left field, nobody would have ever considered the socialist candidate, but he made things feasible 20 or 30 years down the road. And I could potentially see something similar with Bernie Sanders. I mean, look, what he's been pushing for with college tuition costs and healthcare are problems that you hear time and again from voters. Those are not sort of minuscule problems that will go away. So I think they will need to be addressed, and how they're addressed, who knows. But I think in some ways he has certainly lit a fire for folks to pay attention to these issues.
McKay, is that a divergence then? If Donald Trump, you say, is sending a message, little guy and gal, I'm on your side, I'm going to help take care of you, that sounds something like what Asma is describing from Bernie Sanders. You will not be ignored. Your real material interests are going to be taken into account in a new way. So is that a fundamental fork there? Or is it two versions of a similar appeal? If those impulses stay active in our political system, how do they play out over time in their similarity and in their differences?
Well, I think that on the left, you have to, to channel those impulses into political gains, you need to do exactly what Bernie Sanders called for in that speech, which is get your voters who make sure that it's not just lightning in a bottle, one-time thing, turn that, feel the burn revolution into a bunch of, hundreds of state races and local congressional races. This is essentially what the Tea Party did in 2010, right? The reason that we have so many conservatives and such more conservative members of Congress and lawmakers, both in state legislatures and in Washington, is because hundreds of Tea Party candidates, including a lot of people who had never been involved in politics, went and ran for office and got all their people to turn out. And either they won the primaries or they dragged the people in the primaries, the incumbents, to the right. I think that you can make a case. Look, I mean, you have to remember that Hillary Clinton is her husband stood for a fairly moderate to conservative brand of the Democratic Party, right?
Third way.
Yes, and you know, you can't equate those two. They have their own visions. But certainly compare what Hillary Clinton was calling for in 2008 to what her agenda looks like now. You can absolutely say that Bernie Sanders accomplished a lot and his voters accomplished a lot in making sure their Democratic nominee was much more liberal than I think that they probably expected going into
it. Molly, do you think Hillary will stick with that? If it's Hillary who's elected, and now she's in the White House, and Bernie Sanders isn't, how much of that progressive rhetoric that we've seen her increasingly pull into her campaign's trail presentation actually unfolds in terms of policy?
I think, a couple of things. I think, first of all, we were talking before about whether Hillary sort of runs to the right in the general election to try to mop up a lot of those Republican-leaning, independent, suburban voters that she may have a shot at with Donald Trump on the ticket. I've spoken to a lot of sort of Sanders-supporting liberals who are very afraid of that. They think that she will do this triangulation routine where she does try to essentially run in the general election as a moderate Republican and therefore sells out a lot of the real forthright muscular progressivism that they would have liked to see. On a lot of Bernie Sanders' core issues, Hillary seemed to adopt some of his rhetoric, but she didn't take up his positions. She didn't say she'd break up the banks. She didn't say she would propose a $15 minimum wage. She retained her sort of economic centrism in a lot of ways, a left centrism to be sure. But so it's a real question whether she will, which kind of candidate she'll run as, and then of course which kind she would govern as if elected. And I think that might depend also a lot on the composition of the Congress and what kinds of things that then become, that then are in the universe of the possible depending on who she ends up working with.
Jack, we're going to be headed soon into the home stretch of the campaign. The conventions will be here. On Point will be live at both of them in Cleveland and in Philadelphia. There and on the other side of that, what do you see coming in the campaign dynamics when it's really down and dirty? And if it's Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and if it's personality-driven at some important level, though that's interesting with Hillary Clinton because, yes, she has a very distinctive personality, but she's not a personality like her husband was. Nevertheless, we've seen her show the sword a little bit, sort of pull it out of the scabbard and be pretty tough. If it's these two head-to-head, either when they're on the debate stage or when they're, you know, how it works, slanging each other in the media, how do you see that interpersonal dynamic, the campaign dynamic playing out?
Well, it's so hard to predict anything with the ultimate loose cannon in the race. You don't know what Trump is going to...
Isn't that a kind of predictability in itself?
Yes, in that sense. And it's going to make Hillary seem very dull in her steady on the way. On the other hand... I think her dominant issue is going to be he is much too unsteady. I am a solid person. I'm doing what I've always been doing. I'm going ahead incrementally. This guy is, if he's not a lunatic, he's from the lunatic fringe. And I think that's what it's all going to
be
about.
Yeah,
It's like at the 1964 convention, a Republican operative listening to Barry Goldwater says, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. The Republican turned to Teddy White and he said, my God, Barry Goldwater is going to run as Barry Goldwater. Trump is going to run as Trump. And that's the issue. And I think for Hillary, that is a deeply unpopular person, a candidate, not exciting to many people. Nevertheless, her dominant personal characteristic, it seems to me, is strength. You can't read her biography without thinking this is a person of tremendous inner resources and a kind of, you know, slog it out, fight it out, thick hide, as opposed to the narcissistically thin hide of Mr. Trump. So I think she's just going to project steadiness and he'll be Trump.
McKay, there's a lot of things you can say about Donald Trump. On the other hand, I remember very, very clearly people snorting and laughing at him in the first Republican campaign and debates, just guffawing at the idea that and he has won. And he has won pretty convincingly. I don't think that Donald Trump should be sneezed at on this home stretch, even if Hillary Clinton takes this strategy. How do you see him playing this, right, and how's he going to come after her?
Well, first of all, neither do Democrats. I mean, if you talk to Democrats, they will say, that the big one of the biggest things they learned from the Republican primary process was that all of his Republican rivals, and including a lot of serious people, didn't take him seriously enough going into it. And so people in the Clinton camp are saying, we will not make that mistake again. We're taking him seriously. That's where this line of attack comes from. I remember, though, that first debate. I was in the – Molly was there, too. We were in the press filing center watching, and it was just so – like surreal and ludicrous to see Donald Trump on that stage. And I remember when he first started talking, the reporters just all burst out laughing because it seemed so ridiculous. I don't think you find very many reporters anymore who are willing to think that this is a sideshow. The thing I will say and caution against that idea that, well, he already did this once, is just that he, you know, this is a different race. It's a different electorate. The general election is fundamentally different from a Republican primary, and there aren't 16 different candidates dividing the electorate in a million different ways, where a plurality in a lot of these states is enough to win. Donald Trump needs to beat Hillary Clinton with the national electorate that we're going to have in 2016. And, you know, I'm not, we don't have to say that, you know, take him not seriously, but I think we also have to acknowledge that for any Republican, this is going to be increasingly difficult until some fundamental things changed for a presidential candidate to win who's on the Republican ticket. Donald Trump has a bunch of other disadvantages that he has to contend with. So I still think that the odds are with Clinton.
Asma, if Donald Trump were to turn the key in the lock, what would that require? Who would he have to win over, and how would he do it?
So he could try two options. One is he could try to court minorities, because this is an electorate in which about 30% of the voters are expected to be minorities. So, I mean, the map clearly favors Hillary Clinton. So that's option one. I think at this point, that would be a very hard pivot. The option two would be to focus on his strengths, which is build his base with white voters. If he does that, and if he can boost turnout, we showed, you know, boosting turnout by just small increments and winning, say, white men by a slightly larger percent than Mitt Romney did, he could theoretically flip states like Ohio and Pennsylvania. And this is, you know, sort of the argument that we've heard is the Rust Belt is his strength. I think that is a more winnable strategy for him, to focus on his strength and focus on boosting turnout.
Molly Ball, could you see that happening?
Well, one of the really interesting things that we've seen Trump do this week is break with Republican absolutism on some of these polarizing cultural issues. So he gave very prominent mention, which almost no other Republican did in responding to Orlando,
LGBT,
very prominent
right there with it.
Position to this as a gay rights issue. Mm-hmm. And he voiced support for closing the so-called terrorist loophole for guns.
No fly, no buy.
Right, exactly, which also made Republicans sort of collectively gasp. So if he's willing to touch the third rail on a lot of these issues, if you buy the analysis that Republicans partly haven't succeeded, not just because of demographics, but because a lot of their hardline positions are out of step with the mainstream, then you have him taking some really interesting stances, saying that Planned Parenthood, for example, should not go out of business because it helps women. So we could see a really interesting candidacy here. The question is, will those Republicans still vote for him?
It's going to be an amazing season. We are right in the midst of it. We want to have all of you back as it rolls ahead to look at it one more time. It's been great to be here in Boston with a live audience on 2016 campaign. McKay Coppins, Asma Khalid, Molly Ball, Jack Beattie, our great thanks to you. Thanks to the audience in the hall. This has been On Point Live.
Our show today was taped in front of a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. Before our big panel on the presidential campaign, we had a lot of fun on stage with the 7-piece soul hop band Kyle Thornton and the Company. We'll go out with a little music from that terrific performance. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You're perfect on a hot, boggy summer day, and I don't ever want to be thirsty. So come and sit your picture right beside me. Cause girl, you're like a tall glass of lemonade. You're perfect on a hot, foggy summer day, and I don't want my cup to be empty. So come and sit your picture right beside me. Yeah, 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 yeah.